Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Arnold, and welcome to the second episode of Joint Ventures. Today's episode is on GLP-1s in rheumatology. There are moments in medicine when drugs arrive very quietly and may be prescribed for one thing, but in this case, this drug has started to ripple across disciplines and is really changing things from endocrinology through cardiovascular medicine, and now these ripples have started to hit rheumatology. In 2005, exenatide, which is the synthetic version of exenadin 4, which is a hormone originally identified in the saliva of the Gila monster, became the first GLP-1 receptor agonist improved, in that case for type 2 diabetes. By 2023, drugs acting on the same pathway, like semaglutide, were starting to reshape how we manage body weight across continents and globally. And by 2025, they really started to hit the road with demonstration of clear reductions in cardiovascular mortality, 20% reductions in major cardiovascular adverse events in the SELECT trial, slowing of kidney disease progression in the FLOW trial. And now, relatively quietly and perhaps somewhat awkwardly, they've started to ripple around the rheumatology clinic because we're noticing that these drugs that were initially developed to lower HbA1cs and reduce visceral fats are also potentially suppressing inflammatory components, IL-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and potentially affecting NF-kappa-B signaling. So today's episode is looking at whether these anti-obesity drugs are also acting as immunomodulators, what that means for us and where we go going forward. Are we witnessing metabolic therapy or are we actually witnessing the accidental birth of a new anti-inflammatory era? And I'll hand over to my colleague, Rehan, who's going to talk initially about obesity and rheumatology, and we'll kick off from there.
Thank you, Jack, for setting the scene. I think let's start by initially linking how obesity links with autoimmunity, and then we can smoothly transition to GLP-1 and other incretin-based medications. Connection between obesity and chronic inflammation has been well established for a long time. However, mechanisms linking obesity-associated inflammation to autoimmunity are much more unclear and much more is still yet to be discovered. But what we know that adipose tissue is not just energy storage. It is the body's largest endocrine organ, what produces loads of chemokines, loads of hormones, and has very direct links with the immune system. There's loads of immune system cells in adipose tissue, and what undergoes changes when suddenly adipose tissue starts to expand, what happens in obesity. And we know, as I mentioned, obesity is linked to this pro-inflammatory status, activating pro-inflammatory genes and producing pro-inflammatory cytokines. So it causes this adipose tissue dysfunction, causes changes within the immune system cells, what are in adipose tissue. And then that subsequently probably has some systemic effect, what links to immune cell loss of tolerance, what leads to autoimmune disease. And there has been several kind of proposed mechanisms, what happens there. It's all still not completely clear, but we know that IL-6, IL-1, TNF-alpha production goes up for people with obesity compared to people with normal body weight, and all those are pro-inflammatory cytokines. And it was interesting to look what happens within immune system cell composition within the adipose tissue, and particularly with T-reg cells. So we know T-regulatory cells play important role in developing of immunity. They're meant to keep this immune system homeostasis, to immune system recognize self antigens and not start to develop immune reactions toward them. And adipose tissue particularly have very high proportion of T-reg cells. In some animal models and more recently in some human tissue studies as well, Treg cells contains 50 to 60% of CD4 T cell population in adipose tissue, and that's very high compared to, let's say, lymphoid tissues when it's usually 18 to 20%. And what happens in obesity, these Treg cell counts drastically go down. If someone with normal body weight, the Treg population is about 50-60%, in obesity it goes down to 18-20%. So there is this suggestion that with the changes with the cell composition alongside with increased production of pro-inflammatory cytokines, it all links to this chronic inflammatory state. And then lastly, the hormones what adipocytes produce probably play quite important role as well. Probably the one that has been well established in research has been leptin. And leptin is a really interesting molecule because structurally it's very similar to IL-6. So it makes sense why it has this interlink. It doesn't have only the metabolic effects, but it activates TH1 cells. And with obesity, the leptin levels significantly go up. And it just makes sense with increasing levels of that, the TH1 cells are more activated. And then this cascade, pro-inflammatory cascade, continues from that. So there is recognized changes what happens within the immune cell composition and then activation of pro-inflammatory pathways, what could lead to the systemic immune system dysregulation and loss of self-recognition and leads to autoimmunity.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the other thing I suppose to state is that this is a massive global problem as well. So we're seeing this, you know, we've got a doubling in the rates of adult obesity since 1990. And then, you know, not to throw too much shade at our American cousins, but by 2030, almost half of the population is projected to be obese. So, you know, not
that,
to sort of...
But that was pre-GLP-1 era. So that's
true. Yeah, so maybe we're going to relit this point, but drop it.
The predictions and the scale of the problem is huge, isn't it? And in the last decades, the problem has just got worse and worse. But we often know the prevalence of autoimmune diseases have gone up as well. So people have been trying to figure out why that has happened. Probably the genetic risk factors have not really changed. It's such a too short period for genetic material on population-wise to change. So there has to be changes with the environmental factors. And I think it's very logical to think about obesity because of how hugely that has been becoming more problem.
And it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Because when you look at these autoimmune diseases, you see poorer responses in people who are obese. So you see lower remission rates in rheumatoid arthritis between, you know, obese and versus non-obese relationships. So that's been shown in meta-analyses in the past previously as well. You see that these patients generally respond poorly or less well to TNF inhibition, which is one of the backbones of RA treatment and used extensively across inflammatory disease. We see worse progression in spondyloarthritis. And then we see things that I suppose we would expect to see, but on a greater scale. So, you know, we're seeing worse pain scores in osteoarthritis, knee osteoarthritis, but those outstrip probably the impact of just increased mechanical load. So it's not just baggage, it's you're carrying something that's metabolically and immunologically active, isn't it?
And probably then we know that in some diseases it's much more obvious. I think the best example is psoriatic arthritis. Then we know that the obesity for people with psoriasis, arthritis is the most common comorbidity. And the population data is different, but the numbers around that, around 27 to 40% of people with PSA are obese. Those are huge numbers. And it has been recognized that obesity is the number one risk factor for someone to develop psoriatic arthritis who has skin psoriasis. So we know that, again, it links to back what we just discussed, this dysregulation of immune system, what is that additional factor what keeps driving in autoimmunity to develop further manifestations of one disease. And insulin resistance has been studied a lot. There is an association of developing autoimmune conditions. But the opposite has been shown as well. Increased insulin sensitivity independently is associated with the lower odds of developing rheumatoid arthritis. So that has been shown as well. So there is this different interlinks between higher body weight and autoimmune diseases, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose the other thing is that it's not a fait accompli. You know, weight loss, you know, however that's managed. So previously in the pre-GLP-1 era would have been done exercise or bariatric surgery, I suppose, would have been the other option. You know, weight loss has been shown to improve outcomes, physical function, patient-reported outcomes. Some of those would be expected, you know, improving body composition. Obviously, you would expect to see some of those, but we are seeing reductions in, you know, in disease activity as well, beyond just what you would see from that. Yeah. So it's interesting.
And drugs of survival and circulating through different treatments changes within losing weight. No, obese patients, they remain on the drug for shorter period of times and they circulate due to different treatments. And I can link to that. It's much more to achieve remission or low disease activity with the same condition, but with the obese population to compare and with the normal body weight, it's much more difficult. And I think it's important what you kind of already mentioned. Probably the reasons are multifactorial. Obesity is linked with poor function and higher levels of pain. What will affect patient-reported outcomes? And and most of the studies use some form of those. And then obesity is linked with the other comorbidities as depression, cardiovascular disease, and those are all impacting disease control and remission rates as well.
And I think, you know, the other thing to mention is that, you know, poor disease control, high levels of steroid exposure just sort of makes it a self-perpetuating circle as well. So, you know, we are tying people's hands behind their backs when they're trying to lose weight by giving them medications that will actively cause them to become hungry, you know, increase appetite and drive, increase insulin resistance, predispose them to type 2 diabetes. We are having to do that because we are chasing our tail and controlling the actual inflammatory process. So it's a vicious cycle and it's a very difficult one for people to get out of. And I think that's, for me, why this is so exciting, is being able to actually intervene in a very meaningful, direct way there and break that cycle is hugely attractive.
And it's nothing new. We know that the weight loss, like you said, helps. Like research with the bariatric surgery, where you are able to achieve significant amounts of weight loss, have shown that improves disease activity. It improves patient-reported outcomes. It improves pain levels and functional ability. So we kind of know that already, but obviously bariatric surgery is high cost procedure and it's very limited who is able to receive that. But now with the incretin-based medications, it seems much more realistic and able to achieve that, because you need to lose a significant amount of weight to have meaningful changes in response to the treatment and this disease activity.
Yeah, as you say, it's much more achievable. It has been sort of out of reach for people all for a long time, and this has really brought it to the front of that. So, I mean, you mentioned incretins, just a word, you know, just for those who haven't really been keeping up to speed with it. Incretins are metabolic hormones. They're released from the small intestine after food intakes. There are two big hitters, GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1, which is the one that you hear the most about, and then another called GIP, gastric inhibitory peptide. I'm sure there are others that I'm unaware of, but those are the two main big hitters. And they act by stimulating insulin secretion, suppressing the release of glucagon, and slowing gastric emptying, which increases satiety. But we think about that as a sort of gut-related axis, but receptors for GLP-1 are actually distributed very widely across the body. And we see them in cardiovascular tissue, we see them in kidney, in renal tissue, the liver, the brain. And in our case, perhaps surprisingly, within the synovium and the synovial cartilage. So we see these receptors throughout the body. It is a total body access that's sort of involved here. And so this sort of raises a sort of fairly fundamental question, really, which is that we think about these drugs as metabolic drugs that reduce, that maybe by some other alternative secondary access, you know, reduce inflammation. But equally, are they actually just anti-inflammatory drugs that are happening to reduce weight? And where are we sitting on that spectrum? Mm. Obviously, the most impressive results are in weight, and that's what draws the blockbuster comparisons. But, you know, the more research we do, the more interested we get in this.
I think it's important to emphasize that at the moment, weight loss of fat mass seems probably the main driver of improving disease control and et cetera. However, like you said, we have increasing evidence which shows that the GLP-1 less than GIP receptors are scattered all over the body, and probably I thought the kind of preclinical data, what has been done on the OA mouse models, are really interesting when intra-articularly they have been injected into the mouse with regenerative joint. It has shown that it reduces locally this pro-inflammatory response and improves pain behavior for the mouse. So there is reason to believe that there is additional effect just beyond weight loss and releasing the mechanical stress, particularly in osteoarthritis.
And we see it mechanistically at sort of molecular level as well. We see reductions in IL-6 and nitric oxide secretion within these chondrocytes and macrophages. This is very early work. I mean, it's difficult to draw too much, you know, from this, but it's interesting, and it sort of does thicken the plot a little bit in terms of where we're going with it.
But we are quite late, isn't it, in rheumatology? Like, these drugs have been around for 2 decades.
2005. 2005, the first one came out, and they pulled saliva out of a lizard in the desert.
Yeah, and, so we are jumping late on the train wagon, isn't it? Because, like, obviously, diabetes, weight loss, peripheral vascular disease, improvement in metabolic dysfunction associated liver disease, obstructive sleep apnea, that's all there is evidence RTCs showing significant benefit, even in substance addiction and substance abuse. There's growing evidence that it improves that and reduces the risk. And I think I saw quite interesting data on that. So the effect of various diseases is just growing and growing, probably in just in rheumatology, and we'll discuss it in due course more in detail. We are just in very early days.
Yeah, we're a bit late to the party, aren't we? We're turning up after the candles have been blown out. But it's nice to be here. I mean, I am conscious, I suppose, that we're going to see everything through the lens of immunology and sort of rheumatology and, you know, how much we're projecting onto this. I don't want to overpromise in terms of this early sort of animal in vitro, you know, or animal model data. But obviously we are seeing end organ effects. And so we're seeing end effects in the other trials. So it is interesting. I don't know if I have all the answers for it, but it is very, very interesting at this point.
And I think we have to be conscious as well that then the market is expanding very quickly. At the moment, when I look today, there's 193 different incretin-based medications, either on the market already or in development. So it's going to become more competitive within the field. We'll have much more molecules from single agonists. Now we have a triple agonists. So there will be lots to kind of to use from. And I think that probably will drive the research. They'll become more accessible. The cost, what probably we'll discuss later, is an important factor in all of this, will go down as well with increasing competition. So I think
we'll have to be able to, as well.
We'll have to be able to navigate this very, what feels like very crowded field, very soon, very carefully, with very limited data at the moment.
Yes, yeah. But it's going to become even more so, I suspect, as you say. So should we talk about sort of the big one for, or the sort of the first big one really in rheumatology, which I suppose is the STEP trials in osteoarthritis, which most people will have heard about.
The STEP trials was with the semaglutide, looking at the effect to different diseases, and STEP 9 trial was particularly focusing on knee osteoarthritis, and it's a logical place to start with. We know that there is a significant correlation with increased body mass to the knee osteoarthritis, and then with the improving that, you could improve the outcomes of that, and obviously it did. So they did a 68-week trial, and the trial met the primary outcomes by weight reduction and improving in the pain scores from knee osteoarthritis. Let's say if in semaglutide group pain reduced by 41.7%, in a control plus placebo group it was 27.5%. And talking with people in osteoarthritis field, this is the biggest kind of pain reduction what they have seen from any multiple trials have failed. They have tried different treatments for OA. And no one, there are sometimes some marginal improvements, but this is kind of the biggest one so far. And plus, not only to just improve the pain, improve the stiffness, and kind of improve the functional ability as well. So the data for that is good. And it was tolerated well. The side effect profile was kind of similar to already known. But again, we kind of know this. We already know that the weight reduction helps with symptomatic OA. There was from the Framingham study, it showed that losing, it was 5 kilograms over a 10-year period, your likelihood of developing symptomatic knee osteoarthritis went down by 50%.
Yep.
And this has a dose dependence. More weight you lose, the better symptomatic improvement you have, and an increase in chance to prevent from developing knee osteoarthritis. So I think that the trial didn't really show, and this is kind of more showing by reducing mechanical load, by losing the weight, you reduce mechanical load to the knee joints, but then it helps with slowing down the degenerative process. So, and because all these patients in lost significant amount of weight, what you need to have at least up to 10-15% of your body weight, you have to lose to see these improvements in outcomes. So I think the study didn't show anything new, kind of didn't give any new evidence that we know weight loss works for symptomatic knee OA. It's much more easier to achieve in much more shorter period of time this weight loss compared to other forms as a low carb diet, exercises, other dietary changes, and then always on extreme spectrum it would be the bariatric surgery, what comes with cost and accessibility.
But I think it's just important to sort of say, I mean, we did know what you would, it stands to reason that would be the end result. But I mean, osteoarthritis for years, knee osteoarthritis, nothing. NSAIDs, that was it, you know, 4 years. So to just have something, and that sort of WOMAC pain reduction is massive. I mean, really.
It is. And it makes you think as well, what was it before, that obviously this is pain reduction.
Yeah.
How much it is just purely from reducing mechanical loads, and what is from direct GLP-1 effects locally inside of EM, modulator, immune processes there. And they know it has effects to central nervous system as well. And what effect pain modulation it has there. So there's loads more information what we need to know. And that might make explanation why those pain scores were so good, that it might more additive effects than just purely from reducing mechanical load, what I think proper weight is. I think it just, and I think the time period, it's only 68 weeks, isn't it? So obviously you lose significant amount of weight, but whether you can have structural changes within the knee that quickly, what improves the pain that significantly, it's difficult for me personally to believe that.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just interesting to think about that, you know, we often celebrate quite incremental improvements, you know, in rheumatology and in medicine generally. And I think just sort of seeing somebody come in and say that sort of level of pain reduction has got to be, you know, fantastic for people, you know, in that situation who otherwise would have just been.
But, and I think as well, where it shows that rheumatology is kind of very late in this part, in its part, is that knee osteoarthritis is not recognized as obesity-related comorbidity. Like, you know, especially in UK, when these drugs license, you need to have, I think, 3 obesity-related comorbidities to be eligible for them. And knee osteoarthritis is not there. Despite having this evidence and on previous evidence, knowing that the weight reduction and obesity is directly linked with that, it isn't not there.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because of the profound economic impact of that.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping people off of work, keeping people, you know, the psychological impacts of that, you know, massive. So it's interesting to think that that's excluded from it when I would have thought that. But yeah.
And then it kind of naturally makes you question what is more cost effective, this or knee replacement surgery. What ultimately this is going to be compared to, isn't it?
And we always, you know, one of the things that always comes up with GLPs is, you know, well, what do you do when you come off, you know, when you regain weight, you know, how long can you stay on? But, you know, when we're talking about people with knee replacements that themselves have a lifespan, revision surgery is no picnic. So delaying that substantially, or, you know, the cost effectiveness, as you say, you know, it has to have a role there, I'm sure, at some point. Interesting to see how it sort of teases out, really. So I think, I suppose at this point, it might be worth moving on to talking about something inflammatory.
Some would argue that OA is has component of inflammatory processes out there.
That's true. I will fall on my sword with that comment. I'm very happy to